You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
I'm Jason Kitkat from Crunch, and we supported this work that you're going to hear a bit about tonight. Crunch, for those who don't know, specialise in services for micro-businesses and the self-employed. We've got over 10,000 customers providing accounting, mortgages, insurance and much more. And why are we taking part in supporting this work? Well, we found in supporting those customers that quite often there were policies coming from government that weren't perhaps as friendly to the small business and self-employed as they could have been. Perhaps they even had rather a large blind spot in relation to them. So rather than just being moaners, we thought we'd do something about it. So we formed a community that we call Chorus, which has over 24,000 members, to try and create a voice for the self-employed. But we also wanted to come up with positive suggestions. So last summer, we partnered with the RSA, whose work we hugely admire, and we partnered to develop the report with 20 suggestions in there for policy and how it could be more supportive for the self-employed and small businesses. We think it's an excellent report. We're not going to just put it on a shelf. We're going to go out there and spread the word. We're going to share this with ministers and decision makers and take this further. We think this is a continuation of a debate, not just a one-off piece of work, and hope you'll support the proposals as well. So I'm going to hand over to Sarah O'Connor from the FT, who's going to chair the evening. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. I'm delighted to be here. Self-employment is obviously one of the kind of hot topics of the moment. It's grown enormously since the year 2000. It accounts for about half of the jobs boom that we've seen since the recession. So it's a really good moment to kind of ask, is policy working correctly or isn't it? Ben has written this pretty provocative report, I would say, with some very interesting and controversial recommendations. So Ben will explain a bit about the report, and then we're going to hear from Francis O'Grady, who is the General Secretary of the TUC, and from Diane Coyle from the University of Manchester. And then we'll have a discussion that will involve all of you. And with no further ado, I'll hand over to Benedict Dellett.
Thanks very much, Sarah. So I want to go through three things relatively briefly. First is some context as to why we're all here today. The second is an explanation of why we looked at the issues we did in the report. And third, an explanation of some of the recommendations that we put forward. So we're all here because we know there's been a big increase in self-employment. It's grown by something like 46%. Since 2000 versus about 12% increase for employees. And since 2008, about half of all jobs growth in the UK is owed to self-employment. So it's a big trend. But the question is it a positive development? And if you look at the earnings statistics, you would say it's not a positive development. We know that if you look at government data, the self-employed full-timers earn something like a third less than their counterparts in wage work. And that difference has been growing, albeit marginally, over the last decade or so. So that, combined with some negative media reporting, gives the impression of a community that's in a very precarious and perilous state. And it suggests that this is not something we should be championing. But if you dig behind the headlines, and if you start to look at lots of other different data sets, you realise that this is a very complicated story. For example, there's a government survey that asks people directly, are you satisfied with your income? And what it shows is that the self-employed overall are only marginally less likely to be satisfied with their income than employees. So how does that square with this earnings difference? And there are various reasons for that. I won't go into detail too much about the problems with government surveys and the methodologies there. But for example, one phenomenon we tracked in our research was this issue of state of some of the self-employed being what you might call asset-rich but cash-poor, in the sense that the self-employed are more likely to own their homes outright, which means they don't have mortgages, which means their outgoings are lower. Again, it's not true of everybody, of course, but it's true of some of the self-employed. The community as a whole is also older, on average, than employees, and those who are approaching retirement or after retirement may have made a conscious decision to trade in high wages for freedom, autonomy, flexibility. And when I say autonomy and flexibility, I don't mean it in just the abstract sense. I mean it in a very concrete sense, in the way that some people can only use self-employment to get the freedom they need to look after their own mental health needs, the physical health needs, to care for loved ones, whether it's parents or children. So there are very real, tangible benefits that come from self-employment. Having said all of that, we shouldn't be blind to all the different issues that face the self-employed. So We know that incomes are very volatile, of course. Income goes up and down in line with the market. And there are various different protections that the self-employed forego. So no access to statutory maternity pay, sick pay, holiday leave. There's no such thing as a national living wage for the self-employed. They don't have employer pension contributions, and the list goes on. And for us, the real concern and danger is that the least affluent are locked out of self-employment. So the RSA had done some previous research looking at the link between wealth and entrepreneurship. And what we found was that those who had received an inheritance of £10,000 or more were twice as likely to move into business as those who had received no inheritance at all. So for us, the question isn't how do you save people from self-employment, it's how do you enable more people to take part in the meaningful kind of self-employment that we know exists, can exist, and which gives people that sense of purpose, that sense of flexibility that we all want from our jobs. Which brings us to this report. What we really wanted to do with this report was to find out whether policy could answer some of those challenges and whether it could not just help people to survive in self-employment, but actually to thrive in doing so. So if you look at the last government's efforts under Cameron and Osborne as Chancellor, they had a very kind of pro-entrepreneurial bent to their policies. They were strong advocates of entrepreneurship. They did things like reduce the high rate of corporation tax from 28% to 20%, and it's soon set to fall to 17% by the end of the decade. They did things like introduce a one-in-two-out rule on regulation and red tape. They had a red tape challenge. They also improved access to finance through schemes like startup loans. And many of these initiatives were really promising. They had a big and positive impact, but some of them are quite hard to justify. And honestly, they seem quite shallow in some places. So, for example, if you take corporation tax, the main rate falling from 28% to 20%, who's that benefiting? It's benefiting big companies that make quite large profits. It's not benefiting startups, particularly in the early stages of their business, not making a huge amount of profits. Same with the one-in-two-out rule on red tape. It seems more of a marketing ploy and a PR mechanism than it is something that's really going to help most businesses in the UK. Also, government efforts have overlooked the individual that sits behind that business. So, for example, there haven't been that many initiatives that look at improving access to private pensions, improving access to maternity pay, improving things like access to income protection insurance. All of these things that affect the individual as that person behind the business, not just the business itself. So if there's a core message that comes out of this report, it's that we want to see the government shift from this laissez-faire agenda, which is about cutting corporation tax, deregulating and hoping for the best, towards something that's much more hands-on and interventionist, and to step in and set problems right in a whole variety of areas. So not just looking at tax and not just looking at regulation, but looking at things like pensions, insurance, mortgages, employment services, business support, late payments, a whole different raft of issues. And that's what we try to look at in our report. We don't go into a huge amount of detail because we're looking at so many issues, but we want to raise a debate here and be quite provocative where we need to be. So in terms of some of the recommendations we put forward, we recommend an attempt to equalise national insurance between the self-employed and employees, to some extent at least. We recommend changing business rates. It's an antiquated tax, ill-suited to an era of e-commerce. We recommend introducing a paternity allowance for self-employed fathers. There's nothing at all if you're self-employed and you're a father. We recommend also changing some aspects of regulation relating to home-based working. Francis Hollis, who might be in the room, is a strong advocate for this, and there's some recommendations in there to improve home-based working rights. And also the big issue, which doesn't get enough attention, is universal credit. And we recommend some changes to that because at the moment it's going to be very detrimental to the self-employed, particularly on low incomes. So that's the roundup of what we've recommended.
Great, thank you very much, Ben. Francis, do you want to sort of kick us off with your response to that?
Lovely, thank you. Well, I very much welcome this report, and I think it's very important in terms of putting self-employment on the map as one of the kind of big conversations for Britain, when I think there are an awful lot of people in Britain who are feeling that, shall we say, the odds are stacked against them, and recognising the way that the jobs market has changed. I think one small criticism of the report is I don't think you say much about unions. And actually, trade unions are probably the key organisation currently representing self-employed workers, whether that's in construction, the entertainment industries, or indeed, as you may have heard, drivers like those at Uber, where GMB took a very successful case to challenge whether or not they were genuinely self-employed. So, and I say that because actually unions have an important role in regulating in favour of positive self-employment, where it's a positive choice and where it can be a really good work experience for people, and the sharp end, where we know things are going badly wrong. And I say that because whilst I recognise what you say about self-employed people being more likely to express satisfaction in the way that they're working, the hard truth is that there are 1.7 million self-employed workers who are on less than the government's national minimum wage. And that suggests to me that this significant rise that we've seen in self-employment is part of that bigger picture that is all too familiar of growing insecurity at work in different forms, whether that's 0 hours, temporary agency, what we still call casualisation. And frankly, it would be naive, I think, not to acknowledge that there are strategies around casualisation, as we've seen in whole industries like the building trade, or indeed broadcasting, for example, and not to recognise that that's a real issue. So for our part, we're concerned about pay, the level of it, the coming cuts in universal credit, which will hit a lot of those low-paid self-employed workers really hard, and what is a growing gap now between average pay for self-employed workers and average pay for the rest. You know, we are seeing a growth of low-paid self-employment. We're concerned about rights. We think that all workers, whatever status you have, should be entitled to certain basic rights, and that's why it was good to see, you know, proposals around the paternity allowance to kind of drag rules into the 21st century and recognise how life is for people today, give them the support that they need. But clearly, I think we have to be really alive to the fact that in some cases we are seeing people reclassified as self-employed simply and clearly to strip them of the rights they would otherwise have as a worker, to the national minimum wage, to sick pay, to holidays, to the right to be accompanied by a trade union. These, and for us, these are rights that everybody should enjoy. So I won't go on, I think I'll just leave it there, but I really welcome the report and I welcome many of the recommendations in it, which I think it would be great to explore tonight. But I think it is important that we keep our hard heads on and recognise that not every self-employed person is the next Steve Jobs. You know, in many, many cases, people are on low pay, poor rights and very little social protection.
Thank you, Francis. That was a very useful and interesting perspective. Diane, do you want to chip in?
Thank you. It's a very interesting discussion, and I thought I'd try and be a bit provocative back, because I thought there are some provocative things in the suggestions. I'm an economist, I'm afraid. I feel I have to apologise for it these days.
Not an expert as well.
An expert too, maybe. And so you look at a trend that's so pronounced as this and ask yourself why it's happening, and I could think of four reasons. One is that there's exploitation, that there are workers being reclassified into self-employed to make it cheaper for employers. One is that there are tax incentives to become self-employed or run a micro-business. One is that there are red tape barriers to becoming a proper business, that rather than expanding and employing people, it's easier to work as a self-employed person to do projects with others. And the other is technology, which is what I spent a lot of my time working on. And the way technology comes into it is that when the price of information and communication technologies falls as much as it has in the past decade and 20 years, it changes the efficient structure of organisations. And rather than the command and control, the hierarchies that you get when it's expensive to exchange information, you get dispersed activity, whether that's flatter corporations or networks of companies working together or more people working as individuals for companies. We've also seen the boundary between home and work blurring because of the technology. And that's happening in the way that we all know about, that you can do your work anywhere, so you do, and there are good and bad things about that, flexibility versus invasion. There's also the creation of a lot of media, a lot of value at home. Somebody might be writing open source software or putting entertaining videos for free on YouTube or writing fabulous, interesting economics blogs. And all of that is causing people to switch away from things that they buy in the market to these free open source goods. They're also doing other kinds of work. We've become our own travel agents, doing that kind of work at home. And equally, now when you go to the supermarket, the technology makes you do the cashier's work for them at those checkout machines that always break down when I go to them. So that boundary is blurring as well because of the technology. Now, I think we lack the statistics to understand what's really happening. We've got some idea, and Ben sets it out in the report, about the numbers of people and the average that they're earning and the different categories, but not enough, really, to understand how people are working with the new technologies and with the way the structure of the economy has changed in other ways. But I think of those four things I listed, they're all part of the story. There's going to be a bit of all of them. And now we've got more than 10 million people. I don't know the exact number, Ben. You'll have it on your fingertips. But a lot of people with a policy framework designed for the past structure, which is delivered through firms, through conventional employment. Taxes, pensions, allowances, maternity leave, even the structure of the education system is designed around a kind of structure that's increasingly breaking down. And the assumption that nothing productive happens at home. When lots of productive things happen at home, the things we've always never counted, like caring, and the things that are actually economically valuable in the market, like writing your open source software. So I think there are some really sensible and interesting proposals in the report, as well as some very provocative ones. But I wonder if one could think about it in a more fundamental way as well. And rather than treating these micro firms and self-employed people more like we treat existing big firms and conventional employers, could you think of it the other way around and design a framework of policies, a system of social security in its broadest sense that delivers to individuals rather than through organisations? That would decrease the barriers to growing from being a micro business to being a bigger business, because actually, if you are a very small company, running maternity leave, running sick pay, running the pension scheme, they are all actually quite significant hurdles to get over. That's quite a big step. So you'd get some more natural distribution of firm sizes anyway. I think it would also be in the spirit of the universal basic income conversation, which I'm not persuaded by because I think there are some very difficult trade-offs in there. But if you think of that a social contract in a broad sense as a contract between what the state delivers to individuals, then I think that would be another interesting way of framing that. So I'll stop there. Maybe we can take it up in the conversation.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, all three of you. Diane, let's just pick up on your last thought then, that, you know, maybe we should think about things in the opposite way, and instead of putting all of our expectations for delivering a safety net onto firms, that there should be some other way of doing it, which obviously does fit with the UBI concept. I mean, my reservation about that notion, and I think probably the reason that a lot of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs like it, is that doesn't it just let employers off the hook? I mean, basically you're saying to employees, you don't have to be responsible for any of these things anymore. You don't have to pay people a wage that they can live on because someone else is doing that for you. Do you think that's a fair criticism? And then, Frances, I'm sure you'd want to come back.
I'm not talking about the pay. I'm talking about the structures of the social contract, which are delivered through employers currently. And raising the question about whether policies are best delivered through firms. Of course firms should pay properly and offer favourable conditions. And that's a structure that needs regulation. I think a minimum wage is necessary. I think unions are necessary, actually, because it's more important to think about organisation among individuals if you're framing it in this very individualist way. But my query is whether firms are the right vehicles for delivering the social contract.
By that you mean things like pensions, maternity leave, pay, all of that sort of thing. Frances, What do you think?
Well, I think it's a really interesting question and a really interesting dilemma. But I think what we're seeing now is a transfer of risk to the individual and an abstention of responsibility amongst the corporate community in many different ways, and that's the bargain that does need to be recalibrated between state, individual, and what happens inside real workplaces. I think I'm also really fascinated by the technology point, and I think that's a really interesting one. But again, just to be a little provocative, the TEC, I think it was this week, I'm losing track, put out a report looking at more broadly at insecure work in Britain. One in 10 workers now, either on a 0 hours temporary agency or very low paid self-employment. And in fact, the big increases, the doubling over the last 5 years, came from care and hospitality. So these aren't necessarily high-tech sectors. Education was another one where we'd seen big increases in insecure working. So that wasn't kind of, you know, although Uber and Deliveroo and so on have captured imaginations, it actually a lot of the insecure working is in pretty low-tech areas.
Just on Uber, obviously the GMB's case against Uber was fascinating and we all followed it closely, and it's obviously not over because Uber is now appealing that ruling, funnily enough, and I'm sure we'll appeal it to the bitter end. Yeah. But I don't know if you saw that there was the Select Committee for Work and Pensions is doing an inquiry about the kind of tax and welfare implications of self-employment and the gig economy right now. And on Monday they had a set of gig economy workers come and testify to them. So they started with three. There was someone from Uber, someone from Deliveroo, and someone from Hermes. And then they had another three come in. And it was like night and day. So the first three, who had been suggested by the companies themselves, all came in and said, I love this. You know, this suits my needs perfectly. So there was a guy who's a tennis coach, and he delivers parcels for Hermes in the spare time that he has when he's not being a tennis coach, and he finds it wonderful. There was a guy who works at Deliveroo but also has a full-time job with Sainsbury's and does it to top up his income. And then the next set of guys came in and said, it's terrible, we don't feel self-employed at all, we've got no control over what we do, we can't even make anywhere near the minimum wage. And I guess my question is to you, but actually probably to Ben and Diane as well, when there's such a diversity of experience, how do you design any policy that is appropriate for everyone? Because I mean, I find this in my own reporting, that I meet some self-employed gig economy workers who genuinely do value it, and really the thing that they often say is that it gives them a sense of kind of control over their own lives in a way that being a cog in a corporate machine doesn't. And I think that we can't discount that, and I think that the left in particular would be foolish to kind of dismiss that and say that's not a real thing. But at the same time, there clearly are other people who feel desperately exploited and have no control. So how do you...
I think objectively, frankly, in the cases that you mentioned, they are being exploited, and that's very clear. Some of them aren't even getting the national minimum wage.
But I
think what's important is flexibility is a great thing. And at different times in our lives, you know, if you've got small children or all sorts of reasons why you might really prize flexibility... but it's got to be a two-way street, hasn't it? And the problem is that in too many cases where, you know, if you don't respond to that call on the app, then you lose work from there on in. It doesn't feel like a fairly balanced deal, that power is all in the hands of the boss rather than the worker. So in a very practical way, in construction, for example, where there are people who want to be self-employed or in the arts. But we have agreements on the rate for the job. You know, that seems fair, that people should get the same rate for doing the same job. You know, we have our union BECTU has an amazing training and development and professional support role for many of those workers. So we can make this form of work a positive choice, and that's all we want to do, I think, not annihilate it, but make it positive. And certainly, I think we should remain vigilant against those employers who are undercutting the decent ones by using it as a form of exploitation.
I think a short answer to your question is that we don't actually have enough information about how many people fall into these different categories. And I don't think all of the people working for the new platforms are exploited, actually. Particularly outside London, being an Uber driver is a pretty attractive option, and there are many other, it's a very competitive market, many other taxi cab companies that they can go to. But I don't think we know, and we need more information about that.
I think trying to judge people's precariousness based on their job type is quite difficult. So there's 4.8 million self-employed people in the UK. A lot of those are enjoying their situation. Likewise, with zero-hour contracts, it suits some people, doesn't suit others. Same with agency work, same with temporary work. So actually what we did in terms of how this relates to this discussion in self-employment, what we did a couple of years ago was we did our own survey with the populace, and we decided to create a segmentation of the self-employed, which asked people a variety of questions about their experiences. So we didn't assume, it asked them about their experiences. It got beyond the top-line analysis of financial earnings data. And we split the self-employed into six different tribes based on that analysis. 27% fit within what we call the survivor camp. So those who are struggling to make ends meet, but that still leaves nearly three quarters who aren't in that situation. And even those who are in that survivor category, there's a difference between people who are struggling to make ends meet and want to go back into employment, and people who are struggling to make ends meet but really want to make it work in self-employment. And I think it's just worth understanding the nuance in this community of 4.8 million people. In fact, one of my colleagues will be publishing a report on the gig economy shortly, I think later this month, unpacking some of this kind of detail.
Yeah, there are different figures banded around, for sure.
Yeah. We touched very briefly on universal credit, but not very much. And one of the really interesting statistics in your report, which I wrote about in the FT today, was that 20% of the self-employed are in receipt of tax credits compared to about 11% of employees, which I suppose, if you think about it, makes sense, given that we know that their earnings tend to be lower. But that still implies that actually this phenomenon has been slightly underpinned by taxpayer support. And universal credit, which is going to replace tax credits and many other benefits, is going to treat self-employment really quite differently, isn't it? Do you want to just very briefly get into what the problem is going to be there for self-employed people?
Yeah, so without going into too much detail, because it's quite complex and that's one of the issues in itself. But generally speaking, under tax credits, if your earnings fall, the government tops them up. And universal credit is quite a different situation for the self-employed in that they have their earnings pegged to what's called a minimum income floor. So regardless of, if you're self-employed and the minimum income floor is £1,000, say, regardless of whether you earn £500, £300, £200 a month, you get the same UC. You get the same universal credit amount at the end. So it doesn't really support those who have volatile incomes. And there are a number of reasons why the government is introducing minimum income floors for self-employed universal credit claimants. And one is this assumption that you have a lot of self-employed people who are relying on the state to subsidise their business, so they don't have to go out and increase their profits, and the government will sort them out, effectively. And that's some assumptions being made in DOEP.
Is that fair?
I mean, you're talking about 4.8 million people, so a very small fraction, of course, may be engaging in that type of activity, but I think the minimum income floor is really, really punitive. And the problem is that it takes... So the minimum income floor is only applied after 12 months. So the idea is the government says, you've got 12 months to get your business into a decent, fit state, stand on your own 2 feet, and then we're going to apply this punitive measure. But the problem is that it takes quite some time for people to find their feet, to build up client base, to make a decent amount of income. And anyone in the room who's from an employment service will tell you that as well. And what we did actually, we looked at some government data which tracked self-employed earnings over time. So the same individuals over time. And it showed that those who'd been in business for 3 years or more had actually doubled the income that they had from their business. So the key point that we're making in our report is that for some people it really can work, but they need space and time, and universal credit doesn't give people that time.
I mean, there are two big issues here, aren't there? Which is why I think the Exchequer is taking a big interest in this area. Firstly, they're losing out in terms of income tax or tax because of the growth of low-paid self-employment, which has been significant. And secondly, they are worried in general about the pressure on the exchequer in terms of subsidising low-paid self-employment. So again, there are real and again interesting points in the report about how do you boost the bargaining power of self-employed people, I would say through unions as well as co-ops, but there have to be ways of ensuring that self-employed people are getting a fair rate for the jobs that they're doing. And actually, we all have an interest in that.
Mm. And it's easier. I mean, if you've started your own cafe or hairdressing business, you can imagine that in a couple of years, you would have built up more clients and maybe have more services. You can charge higher prices. But actually, how does that apply to an Uber driver whose fee is set by Uber and Uber can unilaterally cut it when it wants? I mean, that's not the same sort of business. And yet the same rules will apply to them. Right. We must get some questions in from the floor. I think we'll take three at a time. There's a lady at the back.
I'm Sam Winder. I'm from IRSA, Employment Related Services Association. I think it's very interesting, the debate that started up here. I think what the report shows and what the RSA showed for some time is that there's no one type of self-employed person. There are lots of different types. But I think what the report does, which is different to other reports, is it doesn't sit back and judge whether that's good, bad or ugly. It says there needs to be more done. This is the shape of the labour market as it is, and we need to do more about it. I'm in so many meetings at the moment with different government departments where all the policies are focused on employers. So skills, employment, it's all about what employers can do. And it's not taking into account the labour market as is and all the pressures on it. So my question to the panel is, you know, do you think there should be, as the report takes, more of a cross-government look at this issue and more of a priority placed on it? Ben mentioned universal credit, for example, is a very good sort of from DWP, not joining up with other government sort of priorities. Do you think this should be a priority?
Bruce Lloyd from university and semi-retired. But the issue, I think, that doesn't get the attention it deserves when we're looking at all these areas is the creative industries. And I think it would be very useful. It's one of the big growth sectors. It's one of those areas where looking at what has happened over the last 5 or 10 years and where it's going to go in the future and how it relates to self-employment and the entrepreneurial sector as a whole will give us some very useful and probably very different insights compared with the tendency to look at it within the traditional industries. Except, of course, sometimes we look at, you're looking at the gig sector, and that overlaps a little bit with the creative industries. But the creative industries is much more important in London now than banking, and it doesn't get the attention it deserves.
That's a good point. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My name's James Sinclair. I'm a lawyer, a social entrepreneur, and a part-time academic researcher. I'm going to invite you to speculate a little on the elephant in the room in this discussion, which is automation. And I raise it because I think that the discussion we're having now is very much the vanguard of the discussion that we're going to be having a lot more of in 15, 20, 25 years' time, when arguably we're all going to have many more skills. We're all going to have to work in different types of employment because the idea of a job for life or a company for life, which has already largely gone anyway, will potentially disappear completely. So actually the policy responses that we come out with now, I think, are really important to essentially design the framework within which we might all have to live in the years to come.
Excellent. Three really good questions/points. Thank you. So to start off with, Sam's question on whether, you know, this should be more of a kind of a cross-government look. I mean, at the minute, we do have the Treasury looking at whether they ought to equalise the tax stuff. You've got DWP doing universal credit. You've got Department of Bays liaising with your own chief executive, Matthew Taylor, on employment rights? I mean, it is all very much spread out across the park, isn't it? What do you think about a bit more joined-up thinking?
Wouldn't it be wonderful?
Yeah. And there's certain quick wins. So Bayes, for example, I may be wrong about this, but they had an enterprise directorate, which was meant to galvanise and provide a bit of leadership on business support initiatives. I think that was disbanded, and I don't know if it was replaced. And so there's kind of obvious things that shouldn't have happened, which they could kind of replace and backtrack. But joined up thinking. But I think this comes back to the bigger point that we're trying to make in the report, which is that supporting businesses isn't just a Bayes job. It's a DWP job. It's a DCLG job. It's even a Department of Health job. And the government needs to think about supporting self-employed across a whole variety of different areas. And that means looking at pensions. It means looking at access to insurance. It means not just looking at tax and regulation. It means looking at access to mortgages and so on. And also, it's not just what the conversations that happen within government. It's the conversations that happen within government and between those guys to the private sector too. So talking to banks, talking to insurance providers, mortgage providers and others.
I suppose just taking a step back, I think we may have kind of moved on from the era when, the big political priority was any job is better than no job. That was the kind of message, get into work, and that solves poverty. And then it became clear, actually, with the over half of poor children in families with at least one parent in work, that wasn't the answer. And it feels like we're moving into a stage almost kind of beyond political party affiliations, where the debate about fair and decent work is gaining more ground, and that this is something that, you know, people are debating across the spectrum. So, yes, I'm all in favour of joined-up government, and I suspect that the Taylor Review actually will have to take on some of these bigger issues beyond the immediate questions of rights, because, you know, this is now a significant, I think it's important not to exaggerate, actually, the extent to which insecure work exists. It's a big and growing problem, but it's not the mainstream experience. But nevertheless, it's significant. And, when it comes to support services, and as you say, there have been lots of initiatives around businesses, not perhaps initiatives around how do we support self-employed workers. If we think collectivising, certainly in terms of my son's experience in the arts, they are constantly connecting in collectives, overlapping collectives, and support each other by giving each other work. You know, I mean, they are organising, it's just in a different way. But are there ways to actively support people to do that? And just finally, again, I don't want to sound like an old so-and-so, but this debate about technology isn't an act of God. We can make policy choices about technology that can work to improve people's lives and bargaining power and satisfying work and everything else that many of us in this room would think is a good, a public good. It doesn't have to be a dictator or tyrannical or stripping people of power. You know, it can be a force for good. It's about decisions that we take to shape it, invest it in it, and who's in the room often. You know, if you look at some of the initiatives that have been, if you only have young men of a certain background in a room deciding what's the latest exciting thing to develop, well, it's not surprising we've ended up with a very big games industry. But I kind of think that if we had different people in the room, we might actually create other sorts of products and initiatives that could be for the benefit of our public services, of working people and so on, and create satisfying, skilled and well-paid work.
I think we still have a games industry. There'd just be different games.
Yeah, sorry, that wasn't a good example, but you know what I mean.
The automation point kind of speaks to my point about needing a system that focuses on people and not on employers. Because I think there will... I'm not a pessimist about what automation will do, but I think there will be a lot of change in the workplace because of that. And we don't need pensions for the robots. We need a system that serves people. So I sympathise with where you're coming from on that question. On the creative industries, absolutely it's bigger than finance around the whole of the country, not just in London. And the impetus to start that process came with the creation of Channel 4, actually, and the BBC having to outsource a lot of its production. And so the independent production companies set up, which are small companies that tried to cut costs. And a lot of the pressure in the precarious sector actually comes from the kinds of industries where cost pressures are very intense. Social care, governments cutting budgets, so the employers cascade that down to their employees. In the creative sector, there used to be this fantastic government subsidy for people called unemployment benefit. You used to be able to get unemployment benefit if you worked in that kind of sector. And as a long-term investment, it didn't always work out, but it was a very successful way of creating a sort of body of skill and experience that has served us really well over the long term. And I think that actually goes to the debate about an industrial strategy. It's not about picking winners, but it's about the structures of support that the state gives to people and the structures of investment and training that are necessary so that whatever turns out to be successful, whether it's, you know, hang and shoot 'em games or much cuddlier games than that, can evolve and help us prosper.
Wonderful. Let's get some more questions. Oh, so many questions. OK.
Thank you. My name's Colin Crooks. I'm the founder of a social enterprise called Tree Shepherd, and we currently support about 400 or 500 people in Lambeth and Southwark towards self-employment. And they're all, 95% of them are starting from a position of being on benefit. So they're all low-tech. We don't have an app builder in sight. I don't think they'd know what one was. So we're all talking about catering, cooking and things like that. And I want to really talk about this low-tech sector and people who are setting up genuine businesses to sell a product to a market, not as fake employees. I think that we've almost contaminated the phrase self-employment now with this Hermes sort of aspect. So I really want to sort of move the debate around how can we create a better, more fairer market for people who've got relatively low capital in a market that is encouraging and encouraging people like Starbucks with high rates, high rents, and squeezing out small businesses that want to try. And the people I'm supporting have been squeezed by the system. They are older, they come from an ethnic background in the majority, and they have been hugely discriminated against in the job market, and they see their natural creative cultural skill of cooking or catering or sewing as something they can make a living out of. But we need to support them more, and I've been advocating an L plate for learners. These people struggle with the system, and I think we need to give them a year's grace of support by the system. And I would include housing benefit in that. It's the biggest single barrier. Universal credit doesn't even touch the size. Housing benefit is the scariest loss of benefit. It's to lose your roof because you're trying to set up a business. So my question really is, what can we do to support people in low-tech businesses that genuinely want to get a business going? And can we move away a little bit from this thing about Hermes? What can we do to support real people trying to set up ordinary businesses?
Hi, my name is Robert Shaw. I'm a management accountant and a fellow. I wanted to pick on something that Francis O'Grady talked about, which was extending the franchise of unions beyond traditional employees. I hadn't thought about it this way until you made that comment. I was focusing on recommendation 20, which is about strengthening the protection against late payment. For micro businesses that provide services to large organisations, the habit of late payment can actually kill those businesses. Cash flow is the most critical factor to keep businesses alive. With 20 years of employment behind me, I've seen very effective trade union negotiations on behalf of employees at all times in their career cycle. I've not come across any organisation that can represent micro-businesses or the self-employed. And this extends beyond micro-businesses. If you look at those victims of the recent HBOS scandal. They were running businesses with several employees, but they had no legal redress. One of the great innovations of the 20th century was the extension of legal representation through trade unions. The legal system in this country does not work for small companies. What role do you think this report and the policymakers should have to help those small businesses get access to justice? Because justice delayed is justice denied. Cash delayed puts more businesses out of business than anything else.
Excellent. Very valuable point. Thank you.
Thank you. Robin Williamson from the Low Incomes Tax Reform Group, which is part of the Chartered Institute of Taxation with an interest in the unrepresented low-income taxpayer, including very small micro-businesses. There's a lot of concern at the moment about the extent of administrative burdens being heaped on small and businesses by the government. In particular, just to take one example, we have HMRC in just over a year will make it mandatory for all businesses with a turnover of over 10,000 a year, that's turnover, not profit, of over 10,000 a year, to keep their records in digital format and to report to HMRC quarterly and then do an end-of-year declaration within 10 months of the year end. So 10 reporting events to... five reporting events to HMRC a year. At the same time, universal credit has been mentioned. The accounting arrangements for universal credit are that businesses report monthly to DWP, and they compute their monthly results on a different accounting basis from the quarterly results, which they have to report to HMRC. Now, I could go into great detail about the differences in the accounting basis and why it's not going to leave them much time to do their business. But are there other sectors of government which are similarly strangling small businesses with this kind of bureaucratic red tape? Thank you.
Excellent, thank you. So this is the advantage of having a very expert audience. Ben, do you want to go in first?
I'll do a whirlwind around all three of those. So all brilliant questions. Colin's point about supporting low-tech businesses. I think there are two ways of looking at this. There's a kind of technical fix, what government can do in terms of addressing issues with universal credit, housing benefit, business rates of people operating properties. But then there's a value fix. In some of these sectors, they're low paid, but they're not necessarily low skilled. And I was talking about this earlier with colleagues, care being one big example, teaching assistants, kind of professions that require a hell of a lot of skill, but we don't really think they're skilled, and so we don't value them as consumers. And so there's a big value question that we have to have there, or debate, should I say. In terms of the gentleman's point about late payments, I don't know enough about the legal system to comment, but one thing I'd quite like to mention is a kind of non-government response to that. So we're actually going to be looking at this with the FSB shortly, but there's a variety of grassroots initiatives where the self-employed band together to support one another, and there's a scheme in Belgium, I think, called SMART. And in practice, what happens is that you have a group of, say, 20, 30 self-employed people, and they put a small amount of money into a collective pot, and they dip into this pot as they're awaiting payment from a client. So it's trying to pool risk among your peers. So it's one aspect of this kind of mutual way of looking at problem solving. And then the third question around administrative burdens. Yeah, this is quite contentious, because some people would say that making tax digital is a positive development, but there are questions over the time scale and trying to push people into this kind of reporting requirements in such a short time scale could be problematic, but other people say it could just make things so much easier for the self-employed, in terms of having all your details in one place. Some of it is pre-populated, without going into too much detail. But I think the big issue, to take a step back, is the fact that you have different government departments asking for different sets of information over different timescales. That's obviously going to create lots of problems. So there has to be some joined up working, to come back to an earlier theme, between government departments, DREP, BEIS and others.
Thank you. Francis?
So many good questions and insights as well. I mean, I can't help but notice you said many of the people going through the programme have faced discrimination, and that's why they're there. And it, again, just illustrates, you know, the complexity of choice, really, that many of us are choosing, but choosing the best we can in the circumstances, and a free choice, genuinely free choice, might create something else. But what I hear from you is that this isn't just about fixing the system. Actually, what you're doing, it sounds to me, is providing a kind of holistic support, you know, seeing people as human beings, and no doubt that will be as much about how do I find the childcare, how do I fill in these forms, what do I do if I'm not getting enough housing benefit, the whole lot. So, and it seems to me that we don't have enough of that support currently. Again, traditionally, it's the kind of thing that many trade unions provide, you know, so that you do have that person you can talk to, a real person. You do have legal advice, you do have, you know, benefits and other sorts of support. But critically, you have a voice. Because I think, kind of moving on, I think one of the other problems is that self-employed workers, in our experience, can be in a really vulnerable position themselves. So if you complain about that late payment or the way you've been treated, then are you going to get another job from that person? You know, so again, it's this issue of power, and unless you have somebody else kind of saying that without pointing the finger at you, you're going to be in a very, very vulnerable position. And I mean, I'm hoping to speak at the Small Business Federation conference, and I did a kind of blog for them saying actually we have a lot in common, and I think increasingly so in today's market, because you know, many people do feel that the heads of supply chains, on which everybody else is dependent, and it can go a very long way down, you know, have a lot of power. And that if you're even if you're midway or at the bottom of that chain, you don't have a lot of power, because so much of your business or your employment is dependent on them. And that, again, is, I think, a really important theme for this work going forward, that it addresses not just fixes in how the government works, but actually how we work as a society and an economy, that you can have genuine choices about your status at work, but you don't end up paying a bloody big penalty for it, and that you are able to band together as you need to even up that bargaining power.
I just briefly add one thought on Colin's question, which is that something that happens at my university, the University of Manchester and others, is procurement policy, actually buying services from local companies. And that could easily be done through the public sector, and it could easily be done through the rest of the private sector too. And it's a very obvious way to help support those businesses.
Like one sentence questions. Okay, we'll have this man here because he's very smiley, this lady here because she's very smiley, and this man because he's got an excellent beard.
Hi there. Josh Kies, a fellow, very fast. One comment. Some unions do work well for freelancers, the NUJ, for example, journalists. They're extremely active support in freelancers. So just as a comment. People who are vulnerable include people in receipt of disability benefits. And I glanced through the report, I didn't read it completely, but I didn't see any mention of people with disabilities. And there's a lot of tension about disability benefits, people who are freelancers being carers, and people who, in order to be a freelancer, need a carer, and they're risking losing these benefits. Could you mention something about that, please? Thank you.
That's a very good point. Thank you. And yeah, this lady here.
I'm a name is Frances Hollis. I'm architect and academic from London Metropolitan University, and my area of interest and expertise is the architecture of home-based work. So I want to throw something else completely into the pot that hasn't been mentioned, which is that at the moment you're saying one in seven are self-employed. One in seven actually are home of the employed are home-based workers as well. So there are very major implications for the built environment. And I would like you to say what you think about this and whether you think that this is going to carry on increasing. Because at the moment, I think it's an incredibly exciting time that we need to, in a way, really start to change the way we conceive our cities, our towns and our villages. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
The implications of Brexit on particularly seasonal work, where both ways, actually, people coming to the UK, but also people that are trying to get sort of contracts from abroad, and also the organisations themselves that rely on lots of seasonal workers, and just be interesting to find your comments.
Excellent. Yes, I can't believe we almost got through a whole session without talking about Brexit. But you've saved us at the last minute. Great. OK, we don't have a lot of time. So if each of you just want to pick up on one of those points, that would be brilliant. Diane, do you want to start?
OK, home-based work, I think it will grow. It has lots of implications for the built environment, but also things like insurance policies and infrastructure, including transport systems, and also how we calculate productivity, because people are using their own capital equipment at home. So I think it's got really big ramifications.
Can I say something about that too? Because I was absolutely delighted to see your report covered health and safety, because it's so often completely ignored, and yet it's a really, really big issue for home-based workers, whether they're employees or self-employed or freelance. And not all of us have mansions. I really hope he never sees this film, but my grown-up son, who's now back at home, as so many are, has completely taken over my kitchen, and I would be so delighted if he had other opportunities for space too, I visited recently the pop-up studios that have been organised as part of the Crossrail project, where they've kind of on a temporary basis opened up good space where designers, artists can work for a small membership fee and also meet each other. Because actually, home-based work can be really lonely. Mm. So, to have a social space where you can work at a really cheap price and you've got good equipment and Wi-Fi and everything else you need seems to me fantastic. And if we had more of those spaces, again, that helps people organise together, which I'm always ultimately interested in.
Excellent, thank you. Do you want to talk about Brexit and disability?
You've landed me with Brexit.
Someone has to do it.
And I've got to do
it
in 10 seconds.
Yeah, 10 seconds.
Can I pass? This is such a complex, tough issue, and there are lots of winners and losers, and the RSA is a politically independent charity, so I can't fall on two sides or the other.
Ben, what a cop out. Francis, do you want to do Brexit?
We can do with the right to remain straight off. I'm fed up of people being used as a bargaining chip, full stop. I think we should. I think I would like to see employers investing more in training so that people do get a chance to get into jobs. And frankly, some jobs that I've seen firsthand are so low paid, so long hours, so exploited that I think it's outrageous that our minimum wage is so low that there is no incentive on the employer to invest in mechanisation and technology to remove some of the most boring, exploited jobs and replace them with good ones.
I'll say one thing about Brexit, which is there's a danger that it consumes all of our attention and all of the commentary around policymakers, and we forget about the variety of issues that are of equal importance, the crisis in social care being just one example. So that's just a kind of red flag.
Do you want to talk very quickly about disability benefits and care?
Yeah, we did touch on this very, very briefly. Sam Winder at the back from IRSA will know more about this than I do, but you have an employment service work programme, which if people have been out of work for a year or more, as present, they would have access to this employment service. It's being changed now, so that if you're out of work for 2 years, then you have access to this new programme, which is called the Work and Health Programme, and it's mainly focused on those with disabilities. So there is still a mechanism, and there will be a mechanism, to help those who are disabled into self-employment. So it does. There is something that exists, but just to come back to this big issue of universal credit, it's going to affect disabled people just as much as everybody else, and it needs to be amended. And we need to start talking about it much more. And if I could say one more thing, it's that I know that the conversations have somewhat been downbeat, and when I mentioned at the start, I said that the question for us at the RSA is not how do you save people from self-employment, it's how do you enable more people to take part in the good kind, the meaningful kind, that we know really does work for a lot of people. So if we can steer our attention to the second question, that would be good.
Good spaces to work with.
Exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really nice way to end. Thank you so much, everyone, for coming, and I'm sorry that we didn't get all of your questions in. Yeah, hopefully we can keep the conversation going, and thank you very much again.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.